She was defending us.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It's Wednesday, May 6th.
Banks are paying some.
Good afternoon, committee. Going to start out with some public hearings. First, you'll note that I may be trying to do some work sessions after 4 o'clock. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 685. Victoria, will you give us a brief presentation on Senate Bill 685?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 685 prohibits creditors from denying credit to applicants solely because applicant used business address instead of residential address if state law or local ordinance permits use of business address on application. This bill passed the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Administration 401 and passed the Senate unanimously.
One of the ones we got to watch.
Up first, Senator Pazansky. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to explain this bill to the House side.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's good to see you all, especially my representative there with the gavel in hand. The Senate bill that's before you, 685, is one.
And if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
I will. And it is before you, and my name is Floyd Pazansky, State Senator, District 4. And the reason the bill is before you is that we wanted to make certain that individuals who had the right under state law or local ordinances to use a business address on an application or use a business address in lieu of their residential address would not be, denied credit based solely on the use of that business address where it is in fact permitted by law. Specifically, I can give you examples of individuals that do fit the definition to use a business address instead of their residential address would include law enforcement personnel and others within the criminal justice system. Not everyone has the authority to do that, but those that do, we believe that it is appropriate to allow them to use that business address for business purposes without being penalized by a creditor. Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony. We'll be willing to answer any or attempt to answer any questions you or your committee members may have.
Chair. Representative Krieger.
Senator, did anyone come into the committee and testify or oppose this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, the only opposition I heard was in the hallway where a lobbyist said that he thought that this might only pertain to creditors that are within the state as compared to a federal creditor. And I did not hear anything else, and that individual did not testify, to my knowledge, on the Senate side. And I believe that the state has the right to allow certain individuals, because of their risk and their employment, to use a business address. And I would hope that if the creditors that may be under a federal charter would take those things in consideration.
Okay. Any other questions for the senator? Appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I keep trying to figure out how I can weave something else into this bill but to protect the addresses of legislators, but haven't got there yet. So appreciate that. It doesn't appear that we have any opposition. There's no one else signed up for this bill. We'll probably work this bill a little bit later today.
Mr. Chair, if you need me for some reason, I will be in the Senate Commerce Committee in Hearing Room B. Thank you.
Keep that in mind. Thank you very much, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 685? Not seeing any, I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 685 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 203A and Senate Bill 205. And first up, we have Craig Smith from the Construction Contractors Board. Oh, Victoria, would you please give us a brief description of Senate Bill 203 first, and then Senate Bill 205.
I would be happy to do that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 203A makes Oregon lien law consistent with Construction Contractors Board statutes by establishing the same threshold requirement of $2,000 for a written contract and providing the information notice to owner about construction liens, increases renewal period for an expired license, and authorizes CCB to sanction exempt independent contractors who hire employees. Deletes requirement that written residential contracts contain a summary of notices and eliminates contradictory language. Senate Bill 203 passed the Senate Business and Transportation Committee unanimously, passed the Senate with no nay votes. Senate Bill 205 specifies type of work on a residential structure or zero lot line dwelling that is subject to written contract and clarifies applicability of contract cancellation terms. Expands warranty offer requirement to include newly constructed residential structure or zero lot line dwelling sold by contractor. Adds original purchaser to persons receiving consumer notice form. Specifies time for contractor to provide recommended maintenance schedule. Eliminates requirement that CCB make recommended maintenance schedule information available without charge. Senate Bill 205 passed the Senate Consumer Protection and Public Affairs Committee 401 and passed the Senate with no nay votes.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Smith. Chair, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. It's good to be back today with a couple of our own bills. Today I'm joined by Kathy Dolan, who is a policy analyst with the board. We have before you two bills. For the most part, these bills are fine-tuning or streamlining of previous policy issues that you addressed last year through quite a bit of work and toil. The handouts that I'll have for you today will allow you to take a look at some of that stuff, and they will also suggest to you some revisions that we believe correct some conflicts and further streamline the laws and make it more enforceable or usable for the people of Oregon. To that end, we've prepared a PowerPoint that will, with your permission, if we can show it, that'll talk a little bit about how some of the bill that you passed last session from the Task Force on Construction Claims has gone into law and how it's being practically used today. And so with your permission, I'll turn this over to Kathy Dolan, who will go through the PowerPoint.
Thank you. Permission granted.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kathy Dolling, and I also have no clue how to do this, so is there somebody who knows how to load
right, the power? That's what they all say.
Let's hope Cindy, does. If not, we'll send Representative Riley down there.
Show you a little bit about what's in your packet while we load this. You've got on 203 a one-pager on top that's effectively an executive summary. The next two pages give the detail about those changes. Page number 5 in your packet is a useful product because we're going to talk about the notices that are required by construction contractors. And those notices include page 7 in the packet, which is the current consumer protection notice, page 8, which is a notice of procedures. That's an interesting one that talks about what a consumer must go through in order to file a lawsuit with a contractor. And then lastly, which is the subject really of this bill, the information notice to owner about construction liens, and we've talked about this quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. This is the infamous notice that talks about the pay twice situation. We think that a lot of contractors, so now I'm vamping. We think that a lot of contractors give this out. Sometimes it's not given out. Obviously, it's an important provision of law. It puts a few I think consumers at risk that should not be at risk, and of course with the bill that you passed out, that 2366, and it was an interesting vote, I thought, on the floor, and so I think it's a wonderful thing that that got through the House. We'll see what happens on down the road. While we're working on that, perhaps I can talk to you a little bit about what this bill would do. In Section 1, it would make the trigger.
We're ready whenever.
And we'll just use that as a mystery, and we'll get right back to that.
The trigger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Riley. This is just a brief PowerPoint we wanted to present to you so you can understand, based upon a lot of the work, frankly, that you did last session, what we now have by way of contract and notice requirements for residential construction. Good thing you guys have these really smart people here.
Uh-oh.
There we go. Thank you
very much. Just keep using that button to go through, and if you want to back up, use that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Over the last 30 years, Oregon significantly increased its consumer protection for residential contractors. There were several new requirements that were added in 2007 based primarily upon recommendations of the Construction Task Force on Construction Claims, which we refer to as TCFF throughout. That was enacted in your House Bill 2654. Just by way of an overview, when a homeowner is having a new home constructed, what we call custom construction, they may expect to receive up to 9 different documents. There's the written contract with its required terms, and again, those terms were impacted by the task force in this last legislative session. There's a contract addendum, which is another way of providing those terms if they aren't included in the written contract. It's voluntary in the sense that the written contract can cover that material. There's an offer of warranty now required since 2007. The consumer protection notice, which has been in existence for a while but was again amended in 2007. There's also an information notice to owner about construction liens, a notice of procedure, a newly added notice regarding moisture intrusion and water damage with a maintenance schedule, a notice of right to a lien from the subcontractors, and a notice of the buyer's right to cancel if the contract was solicited other than at the contractor's place of business. So that's what a homeowner with new construction might expect to see from their builder. A homeowner buying a new home from a contractor, what we call spec homes or homes built on speculation, may receive up to 6 different documents. There would be the sales contract, the information notice to owner about construction liens, also the notice regarding the moisture intrusion and water damages with the maintenance schedule, a notice of the buyer's right to cancel again, and in addition to that, there's a notice of compliance with the Home Buyer Protection Act, which was, I believe, adopted in 2003, and if it applicable, a waiver of the Home Buyer Protection Act's protections. The written contract is basically a requirement that all residential construction for $2,000 or more be in writing. And there are certain terms since 2007 that must be in that contract. There must be a statement that the contractor is licensed by the board, the name, license number, address, and phone number of the contractor. There must be an acknowledgement of the written offer of warranty and whether or not the customer accepts or rejects that warranty. There must be a summary of several notices that are required, including the construction lien notice under 87093, the consumer protection notice, and the notice of procedure under 701330, and the water and moisture damage and maintenance schedule under 701-335. So in addition to having to give these notices, the contractor also has to put a summary of them in the written contract. There needs to be an acknowledgement of the receipt of the maintenance information. There needs to be an explanation of the property owner's rights under the contract, including an ability to file a claim with CCB, and the existence of any mediation or arbitration provisions have to be further explained. I'm just going to quickly go through this because there's one in your handout, but this is just a sample contract that the CCB has prepared and put on its website that I've filled in, just to give you sort of an idea of what kinds of things have to be and would normally be in a bid proposal and contract. And I've tried to highlight, it's a little hard to see on the screen, but I've tried to highlight some of the things would have to be in the contract. Here, this is just the informational items like the names and the addresses, the license numbers. Here it would be this acknowledgement of a written offer of warranty, the summary of the required consumer notices. Here would be an acknowledgement of receipt of the maintenance information and the explanation of the homeowner's rights. And the other method of providing that, again, which is available on our website, is a contract addendum, which if a contractor decides rather than trying to fit into the sample contract, they simply want to attach an addendum to their existing contracts, we let them use this form, which contains the various different pieces of required information in one form. The written offer of warranty was one of the newly enacted requirements in 2007, and what it does is it requires that a contractor who contracts to construct a new home has to offer a warranty to the property owner. They don't have to provide a warranty, they have to offer the warranty. As it's currently written, the requirement does not apply to contractors who build on their own property, then sell the house and the land, what we've been calling the spec builders. If the contractor makes the offer before the contractor and the owner sign the contract and the owner refuses the warranty, then the contractor may withdraw the offer to construct the construction. And there's no specific required form of warranty. It can be anything the contractor chooses. Then there's the consumer protection notice, which has been in existence for a while but was again amended in 2007. That requires that CCB will adopt a notice form to inform property owners of actions that they may take to protect themselves in the case of a residential repair, remodel, or construction projects. And in that form, we tell people about contractor licensing standards, contractor bond and insurance requirements, again, the requirement to offer a warranty, and other information as the board determines. And this is the form that we've adopted. And again, it's in your packet. It's a little hard to see here, but we have that on our website. And so you can see that everybody who buys or has a house built gets this form. The information notice to owner about construction liens is required under actually a different part of the law, under 87093. And that, again, requires CCB to adopt a notice that describes Oregon's lien laws. And this form has to include methods by which an owner may avoid multiple payments for the same material and labor, the so-called pay-twice problem, the right to file a complaint with CCB, and the right to a statement of the reasonable value of labor, material, or equipment rental. That's the basis of the lien. And this is what that form looks like. And again, it's available on our website and is one of the several documents an owner can expect to receive in this process. And that's the second page of the document. Then there's the notice of procedure, and that requires CCB to adopt a notice explaining the procedure that a homeowner must follow to alert their contractor before they file a demand for arbitration or a complaint in court. And that's this form, which is also available on our website. Then there's the new notice regarding moisture intrusion and water damage with maintenance schedule. And that law requires that CCB adopt a notice that a home builder must provide to the owner or the first purchaser of a home certain information, the definition and description of moisture intrusion and water damage, an explanation of how moisture intrusion and water damage may occur, a recommended maintenance schedule, advice on how to recognize water damage, and appropriate steps to take when water damage is discovered. And this is the form on our website, and that's the first page, which is the informational page about moisture intrusion and water damage. And this is the second page, which is the recommended maintenance schedule. Builders can use a different version of the maintenance schedule as long as it covers the same things or at least is that inclusive. Then there's the Notice of Compliance with the Home Buyer Protection Act. And again, this is not in our statutes. It's in the 87 chapter. And what it does is requires contractors that sell new homes worth $50,000 or more, or persons who sell remodeled homes with improvements costing $50,000 or more within a certain period of time before sale, to provide a notice of how the seller has elected to protect the buyer from subcontractor or material liens. And there are six options for the seller. The seller can provide an ALTA policy, retain 25% of the sale proceeds in escrow, post a bond or letter of credit, provide written waivers from lien claimants, wait to complete the sale until the last day on which a lien may be perfected, which is usually 75 days, or obtain a waiver from the home buyer. And this is the form that complies with that requirement. And then there's the buyer's waiver of the protection, if that's what the seller and buyer elect to use. And this is the form that complies with that requirement. Then there's the subcontractor's notice of a right to lien, which is also an 87, Chapter 87 requirement that requires a subcontractor to supply a notice to a homeowners before any liens are filed, just telling them that they have the right to file liens. And this is the form that complies. And there's two pages there. Then there's the three-day right of cancellation. And that's in Chapter 83, and it provides that any contractor who enters into a contract other than at the contractor's place of business engages in what's called a home solicitation sale. If the sale of involving construction, and it can involve construction, falls in this category, then the person who is engaged in the practice has to provide two copies of notice of the buyer's right to cancel. The buyer may fill one out and return one copy and keep the other if they decide to use the right to cancel. And this is the form that that's required under that law. And then there's the one-day right of cancellation, which was a new provision added in 2007, again, as part of the task force. And this provides a homeowner who enters into a contract to construct, improve, or repair their home one business day in which to cancel the contract. There's no specific form for this cancellation right, as there is for the three-day. The point of this is hopefully just to help you understand a little bit about what laws we have in the 701 chapter. There's a list of them here, but they're also in the 87 chapter and the 83 chapter that homeowners, home buyers can expect to see various different notices and pieces of paper when they go through the process. And some of the things we're asking to take a look at today are simply ways we hope to clarify and maybe streamline some of those requirements.
One word of explanation on the home solicitation sales three-day right of rescission. That's been amended throughout the years. It's had its name changed. For the most part, that's not applicable on new home construction. And I'm not sure, well, I'll have to double check on that if it ever is. I believe there's an exclusion that we'll have to take a look at that. It doesn't even come into play for new construction. But, of course, the board, a lot of the work is done in remodeling and improvement. And when a contractor is engaged in siding, solar, other home improvements, home additions, that sort of thing, that three-day right of rescission, particularly where the contract is entered into at the home or as has been amended to be any place other than the contractor's office, because sometimes it might be done at the fair, you know, sometimes it might be done at a coffee shop. The idea is to provide a cooling-off period in case that salesperson was a little too good, you know, to give a chance for the consumer to breathe and maybe change their mind. So that's the three-day right of rescission. And then we have the one-day right, and if there's some confusion on that, we'll double-check that and give you some more information on that.
Before you move on to that, I know Craig and I, we just had a previous conversation about this, and I, you know, from my perspective, and this is perhaps for the committees as well as for Craig's information, I am really kind of wondering why we have a three-day right of cancellation for remodel projects, a three-day right of cancellation for home buyers, and yet we have a one-day right of cancellation for a new home construction contract. And from my standpoint, and I know this bill has passed unanimously so far, but I want to have a conversation with the senator on the other side of about this particular issue, because it seems to me it would make sense that that three-day right of cancellation also be applicable to new home construction contracts. However, I'm not going to say that I'm potentially going down that road, but I want to entertain that and have an opportunity to talk to some industry to see if they have a reason for having it inconsistent for this one class of new home construction contracts. Representative Riley.
And along this same topic, I'm curious why we exempt the office. If it's done in the person's office, I don't quite know why that's exempted.
Yeah, I think Chair Hovey and Representative Riley, the way the three-day right of rescission works, it used to be just called home solicitation sale, so that if you had it covers more than just construction. This is for vacuum cleaners and all kinds of things. It used to be that you had a problem with folks going door to door and pressure sales, and it just wasn't right. And so consumer advocates in many states, so you have a federal law as well as a state law, have this three-day right of rescission. And so I think in a few years past, and of course this is not CCB stuff, so I may not be right up on it, but it was extended past the home, so that law kicks in whenever the contract is negotiated other than the contractor's office.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's in the contractor's office, I guess they're figuring that that's, you know, the consumer chose to go there. I don't know all the arguments. I don't know, but that's the last place of refuge apparently for a quick deal. That's all I can tell you.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other comments on that particular topic? I'll let you carry on with your conversation or your presentation, unless you're at the end.
We're ready to walk down the Chair Holdy. On the front page, I have a section-by-section breakdown of what this bill would do. And we left this off with talking about the information notice to owner about construction liens. And the recommendation here in this bill is a policy change to make it so the trigger for this notice would be at $2,000 sales contract price rather than the current $1,000. And the rationale for that is everything else kicks in at $2,000. And we think that it would help the contractors, and we think it doesn't hurt the consumer too much if all of these notices are given at that one rate. So if it's a streamlining measure, I think it would help business. I don't think it would cost much for consumers. In other words, I don't think the relaxation of regulation affects much. And the other argument is this was negotiated, this 1,000 price was in 1983. So bumping it up to $2,000 in this day and age may make some sense. It certainly does to us.
Well, certainly, I guess it makes it consistent with some of the other $2,000 triggers as well.
Chair Holby, that's actually correct. Section 1 also deletes the reference that relates to an oral contract, but that's because the written contract kicks in at $2,000, so it becomes unnecessary. Sections 2, 3, 6, and 7 affect what we believe was an error when we thought this the task force bill out previously. We have a situation, of course, where some folks work folks under the table. We have two classes of contractors. You know, we divide contractors so many different ways, but one of the ways we do it is by the class of independent contractor. And there are two different types of classes. What's known as exempt. Exempt are people that really don't have employees. They're exempt from workers' comp requirements for a variety of reasons. It's a little bit complicated. I have a hard time going through all of the different statutory requirements. Happy to do that if you'd like me to, but there are exempt folks. And then there's the non-exempt folks. And they're the individuals that have more than two corporate officers, as long as it's not family corporate officers. You can have family corporate officers and have more than two. The point is if you have three or more unrelated members in a corporation or a limited liability company, or if you're a sole proprietor and you have employees, you're in the non-exempt class, and you have to have workers' comp, and a lot of different regulations then trigger. In the past, for the past 20 years, we've had the ability to discipline a contractor if they have an exempt license, and that ability to discipline the contractor was, I believe, inadvertently written out of the law, and this would return that ability. So if we chose to go with this bill, it would return our ability to give those folks a fine if they hire folks inappropriately.
Before you move on, just a moment, and it's maybe somewhat unrelated to this bill specifically, but there was some discussion, and maybe I may be in the wrong bill or wrong venue. There was some discussion about requiring even the independent contractors to carry workers' comp on themselves if they're actually performing work. Is that discussion going on this session, or am I dreaming of that?
Chair Hovey and members of the committee, what you may be referring to is discussion that you heard last year concerning commercial contractors. And in that bill last session, 3242, the law was changed for folks that have the commercial contracting license, so that even when they have a sole proprietor, they have to have a certain amount of workers' comp coverage. And so that's just for commercial contractors. It doesn't cover residential contractors.
Interesting. And do you know the policy-wise why it would be better applied in the commercial industry? It wouldn't be applicable in the residential industry specifically, or was it just a policy decision?
Chair Holby, that was a policy decision that was brought to you by the advocates for that particular bill and didn't extend further.
Okay, thank you.
Section 4 and 5 are an interesting issue. It has to do with the ability of a contractor to renew a license that's lapsed. Licenses lapse sometimes because they expire, but also because they lose their license due to bond or insurance problems, and that happens a lot. We suspend contractors $300 or $400 a month because they lose their insurance, and that causes a great deal of grief for the contractor. Of course, sometimes it's hard to get the insurance. It takes them a while maybe to get a bond, particularly if they have credit problems. And from time to time, the clock runs out. What this bill would allow us to do is extend from 1 year and 2 years, the length of time that a lapsed license could be renewed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't help but notice the reference to my constituent. You don't think I read this, do you? What would happen if we just didn't have a limit, or it was much longer, so that the chances of falling behind and not being able to renew? Why do we have a limit?
Sure. Chair Holby and Representative Gilliam, the reason is that the main difference is the ability of the contractor not to have to take the test. And I think the argument from a policy standpoint is that perhaps you can allow someone who is otherwise qualified by taking the test or being exempt for a period of time, but after a while, you probably ought to retest the contractor.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So you get too rusty. I mean, you're willing to say, hey, you're inactive, that's fine, but at some point. I guess I would argue that doubling is good. I'm for that.
But I'd argue for a longer one.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Krieger.
The very situation we're in with our economy where there is no building going on, and these guys have been sitting there, some of them almost a year already, with no income to do the bond, to do the licensing stuff, would be a good example where they're saying we might not come out of this till 2012, be 3-4 years. A good example, we have to be careful.
Yep. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of interested in what Representative Gilliam said, and if you are an active contractor, your license doesn't expire, how often do you have to take the test?
If you're an active contractor, you do not have to take the test again.
So if you could go years and years and years and have taken the test 20 years ago and you're okay.
I'm sorry, Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Riley, that's correct. Of course, if you maintain an active license in the new scenario, you'll be taking continuing education. There could be some additional testing involved in that, and that would be the rationale there.
There's the answer, yep. Continuing education. Thank you.
It's much like me on this committee.
Thank you.
You have to be in the committee.
Moving ahead then. Is the Section 8, which as you saw perhaps in the PowerPoint, there's a lot of notices now. Some folks argue plenty. And one of the things that we've seen that there might be an opportunity for streamlining is what we currently require in the written contract. If, as we do, we require that the actual notices to be given at the time of contract, perhaps we can relax the requirement of putting something in the contract that summarizes that notice. It seems a little redundant to have a summary of the notice and the notice itself given at the same time to the consumer. And if you agree with that, then this bill, at least this section, would take care of that, as it would remove that requirement for a minimum provision in the contract.
So, Mr. Smith, along those lines, I guess my question is, I'm looking at the copies of the notices that you've provided us. You know, it seems that the notices themselves somewhat describe themselves and are look to be understandable. So, I guess the idea of the summary would be to summarize and explain what the notices really are, but I guess your contention is these notices actually do that in and of themselves without the summary.
Chair Holvey, we hope they do. I mean, we try, they're one page for the most part. We try to make them pretty self-explanatory. Yes.
Plain language and all that.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you. Sorry to go backwards here. What if...
Backwards?
Yeah. What if you were inactive and you took continuing education? Would you be open to extending the time that you could renew? If I don't know what's required or how much it costs or all that. Why isn't that an option?
I think that there would be some other policy issues. It might be that Kathy wants to talk on that issue. The licensing folks have advised me that there are some issues about that. I can tell you that the inactive licensees that I've spoke with would appreciate a mandate that they not be required to take the continuing education as it adds to their cost. The plan at this point is to try to keep that down.
I'm all for that. Oh, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I'm all for that, but my question is, what if you are inactive and you voluntarily said, you know what, I'm going to take this, and it, because... First of all, I get the education, but secondly, that gives me another year on my inactive status, or gives me 2 more years on my inactive status. Not a mandate, just an option. That's all I'm saying.
Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam, it's an interesting concept.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
That's a good answer.
I can get this abuse in other committees, by the way.
He does.
Lastly, it's a little difficult to see, but we had a little bit of a page break problem. At the top of page 2, you'll see a couple of other points that a couple of other notices that would go away under Section 8, and I wanted to make sure you noticed those. That is the summary of House Bill 23A, and we would appreciate an opportunity to answer your questions.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question that doesn't relate specifically to this bill per se, but you're here, and I have an opportunity. And that in the presentation, the PowerPoint presentation, it talks about exemptions to basically all of these regulations. If this is a residential dwelling that the contractor built on their own property, I have had a situation involving a constituent that has made me aware that if a licensed contractor builds a home on their own property and then lives in that home for a period of time and sells it, their responsibilities as a contractor are no longer enforceable. They are simply a seller of a home that they lived in, even if there was faulty construction and they're not responsible for it. That does not seem right to me. Believe me, this particular issue is caught up in a very lengthy lawsuit at this particular point in time. But I wonder if you could enlighten me as to why that is.
Chair Holvey and...
It's a great question, and before you answer it, I want you to also answer how many homes can a contractor, or how many homes can a person build per year without being licensed as a contractor? Sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
If you'd answer them simultaneously, we'd appreciate it.
The second, Chair Holvey, Representative Cowan, second question is easier, none. If they're being built with the intent to sell, the answer is none. And the state needs to prove that. Sometimes it's difficult to prove, but we do have a provision of the statute, if my memory serves me correctly, that licensure provides a prima facie case that the person wrote or built the house with the intent to sell. Or if somebody builds three in the period of a year or two years, that's prima facie evidence that the house was built with the intent to sell. To get back to Representative Cohen's point, let me try to clarify. If I understand you correct, this is a property owned by the construction contractor, and it was built in for longer than a year and then sold. And I think the public policy behind that, first of all, is we have a statute of limitations, of course, for how long a claim with the Construction Contractors Board can be filed. And so that's for 1 year. What types of regulations were related to you don't apply? Because I can think of a lot that would.
I'm pretty familiar with this particular situation, and I was keyed to it by the moisture intrusion situation. This dwelling, many things in my area are built on the side of a hill. So this is one of those multi-level dwellings where the living room is on the top level where you actually enter through the garage, and then you've got bedrooms and that sort of thing down two more layers. The driveway comes in at an angle into the garage that goes into the top level. And the drainage that was put into the cement driveway allowed moisture to go directly down onto untreated timbers that were the support system for the driveway and the wall of the second level down of the house. Over a period of a couple of years, I don't know the exact timeline, water that drained down onto these untreated timbers Amazingly enough, timber doesn't last forever in that condition, and when it gave way, the first indication of a problem was the fact that the driveway dropped about 2-3 inches, and when eventually that driveway was pulled out to remedy the problem, the whole wall of the second layer level of the house was rotted and full of gross things that you probably shouldn't talk about. And it was about a $70,000-plus repair job, for which it appears that the licensed contractor who built the house and lived in it for a little while before the problem started has no responsibility. And there's no way that the purchaser of that house could have known what was going to happen until it happened. That does not seem right to me, that there is no responsibility for what you've built.
Right.
Outside of word of mouth, which might be running fairly rampantly through the community.
Yeah. So, Chair Holdy and Representative Cohen, I'm in a little bit deep water here, other than to suggest that, of course, as far as we're concerned with our dispute resolution program, the amount of time is 1 year from substantial completion. It does not affect the consumer's right to sue the contractor or the seller. Obviously, that's a difficult row to hoe.
Well, follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yes, that suit is in process, and it's been very difficult. But I guess more the bottom line is that that's interesting to me, that there's only a year's worth of liability when these are very permanent structures that one expects to live in for a long time, and problems of that nature, even if they were from faulty construction methodology, are not going to show up in a year's period of time. So
right.
I'm interested in the reasoning there.
I'll comment at the risk of speaking too much. I do not want to defend the construction industry. We're in the business of regulating contractors. They can speak to that issue better than I. What they might suggest is that there might be two sides of that story. There are other issues that might have caused the drainage. I don't want to get into it. Because
no, I'm
that's
not going to ask you to.
Okay.
But I was just curious about the thought process.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Ryan, you're closed.
Representative Weiner.
Thank you, President. Holdy, to the bill, please. Would you, right now you're bumping from 1 to 2 years for the license. And as was brought up by Representative Krieger, some of these guys could be sitting idle for 3, 4, maybe 5 years before they jump back in this. Of bumping that number to 5 years? Before retaking the test, because when you get your degree from college, if you don't use that degree in 5 years, it stays with you forever.
Right.
And the test, as having lots of good friends who are contractors, the test doesn't make you a better builder, as in the case that Representative Cowan is talking about, with drain water, not deep water. And just to make it easier on them to get back in the game without having to go through the whole studying and retaking the test again, which for residential construction, or maybe if we limit to residential construction, so in home builders.
Chair Holdy and Representative Weidner, we're happy to do whatever you'd like to do, is the answer to the question. I don't have a strong feeling on that, other than the following. You have to draw the line somewhere. In most cases, what folks do with professional licenses is they put them in an inactive status. It's not uncommon to do so. We've set up a situation that a lot of contractors are using that inactive status, and that prevents them from ever having to take the test as long as they keep their license in that status. The problem, of course, with Representative Gilliam's constituent, and we felt very empathetic with it, was that he'd missed that cutoff by 1 or 2 days, and it was remarkably difficult for us because we empathized with that situation. If you wanted to extend it further, it could be some logistics for us. It could be some problems. But if you thought that was good public policy, we could certainly talk about it. I think Kathy's got some things she'd like to say. And so, again, with your permission, we'll let her chime in.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I think there may be a little tiny bit of confusion here. The issue with Representative Gilliam's constituent was a lapsed license.
Yeah, I don't care about Representative Gilliam.
And in that case, we only allowed them to go back 1 year, and he was just slightly beyond that 1 year, and to become an inactive licensee is what he wanted to do. We'll allow somebody to be an inactive licensee pretty much as long as they want. I mean, they can only become inactive once during a two-year period, so you can't keep going in and out during the license period, but there's nothing to prevent you from keeping that inactive status if you want to. You pay your dues to us, you know, just the fee, but you don't have to maintain a bond, you don't have to pay for insurance, you don't have to take the test. It's really a pretty good option for a lot of these fellows who are in a tough situation right now where they may not want to leave the profession altogether, but they just can't afford everything else. And so that's really the option that's available. That's already in the statute.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I know I have one that's outstanding in my mind as well as, and I'm going to maybe recess this hearing for a couple minutes, but my question is on the warranty. You know, I do recall we had a lot of discussion around the required warranty and debate on whether or not we could make the industry require a warranty and how long that warranty should be. And we eventually, there was a lot of resistance from industry to provide warranties on new homes. And so we just made a requirement that they offer a warranty on new homes. And as I recall, there is no, a requirement on how long that warranty has to be. There just has to be one offered. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, the current requirement is that they offer the warranty, but no specifications on the warranty other than that.
Okay. The part that I don't remember is why we would only require a warranty on a new custom built home,
right,
and not a warranty on a spec home. The difference?
And Chair Holvey, that's what we believe too. We think that what you wanted to do was to have a law that covered both, and what you got was a law that's somewhat ambiguous. So we're recommending that we take that that away and make it clear that it's required for both.
So that's what 203 does. It requires the warranty on both the spec home and the...
It will. And that's on 205.
Or 205, excuse me.
Right. We haven't talked about 205. I've gotten confused because we were talking about this earlier today.
Right.
And perhaps the rest of the committee is wondering, where is that in this bill? But we haven't gotten to that yet.
Okay. Well, with that, if you don't mind staying, I'm going to recess... I'm not recessing. I'm moving to work session so I can get a couple of votes in,
okay,
and then we'll come back to this public hearing. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry for the. I almost sent Krieger outside. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 203 and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 205. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 141A.
Call the speaker.
And committee, if you remember, we dealt with these bills on Monday, I believe. And Victoria, would you just read us real quick what this bill is? Senate Bill 141A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 141A requires real estate commissioner to establish escrow agent licensing system by rule, provides criteria for escrow agent licensing system, requires fingerprint and background check for initial escrow applicant, or upon change in ownership interest in escrow agent, or for corporate officers or individuals in charge of operations. Allows commissioner to require additional information from escrow agent, licensee, or applicant. Grants discretionary powers to commissioner for implementation of escrow agent licensing. Allows commissioner to impose disciplinary action for demonstrated incompetence, failure to maintain surety bond, and acts of fraud or dishonest conduct substantially related to applicant or licensee fitness, even if conduct did not occur in course of escrow activity. Requires escrow agents to follow written instruction of principles in escrow transactions.
And committee, this bill passed the Senate with 27 ayes and one nay. And Representative Riley, I'd appreciate a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 141A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 141A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I don't believe there was any opposition to this bill that was voiced in public hearing and seems to be going forward. No discussion. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Allen?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Excuse.
Excuse. Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 141A, having received required votes, is declared passed. I open a work, close work Carrie. Session on Senate Bill
Carrie.
141A. And anybody want to volunteer to carry this bill?
Oh, yeah, Matthews.
Representative Krieger will carry the bill. Thank you. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 141A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 188A. Victoria, can you give us a brief description of Senate Bill 188A?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 188A authorized the Department of Agriculture to impose civil penalties for food safety violations and to adopt rules to implement civil penalty schedule. Provides for penalties not to exceed $10,000 for each violation, clarifies penalty classification, and reorganizes penalty provisions under relevant statutory sections. Amends statutory provision related to livestock inspection violation to resolve statutory conflict. Makes violation of livestock inspection statute or related rule a Class A misdemeanor.
Thank you, and colleagues, we also heard this bill on Monday. Didn't seem to be any opposition to the bill. No amendments suggested to it. It did pass the Senate with 29 ayes and one excused. And Representative Riley, to entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 188A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 188A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, can you call a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Callen?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Excuse.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Yes.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 188A, having received the required votes, is passed before with a due pass recommendation. Representative Callen, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 188A. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 685. Victoria. Senate Bill 685.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 685 prohibits creditor from denying credit to applicant solely because applicant used business address instead of residential address if state law or local ordinance permits use of business address on application.
Thank you. Committee, we just heard this bill, although Representative Krieger, I believe, brought up an issue. There didn't seem to be any opposition on the Senate or no opposition to this bill. and I'm comfortable moving this bill forward. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, will you give us a roll?
You want a motion?
Motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 685 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley, thank you. Moves Senate Bill 685 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, how about a roll call vote now, Cindy?
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Representative Gillian.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Excused.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye.
Consent calendar.
Yeah. Senate Bill 685 has been suggested for the consent calendar. Sounds like a good idea, and we'll do that. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 685 because it's received the required votes to be passed. Thank you. And with that, I'd like to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 203 and Senate Bill 205. We're not moving these. No.
And back on the record, Craig Smith, Chair Holby, and members of the committee. Are you ready to move on to Senate Bill 205?
I believe we are, because I started asking questions about it.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, we're handing out a little bit bigger packet on 205. This particular bill is similar to 203 in the sense that it addresses several issues that affects the bill, the super bill from the Task Force on Construction Claims. I have a high level review of what the policy issues are, or the minor issues that we want to correct on the front page. And then again, if you have time, and I hope that you do, Kathy's going to go through in detail on pages 4-6 the specific changes kind of line by line and topic by topic, so you have a full understanding of what the bill does. It's a little bit technical in nature, it's a little bit legalistic. But from a high level, let me tell you what it does. From my perspective, Section 1 clarifies when a written contract is required. Right now, there's some language in that section that makes it difficult to know precisely when a written contract is required, and we will talk about that little ambiguity in a minute. It would also clarify what contracts require the summary notices. The summary of the consumer notices, there's some confusion in the bill, and a lot of these have to do with requests we've gotten from attorneys to explain to them what the bill or what the current language of the statute means. And when we've gone to AG or try to look at it, we see question marks rather than definitive statements. And so part of this is our request to try to make this clearer for both us and the folks that we serve. It would also remove the requirement that maintenance schedules be acknowledged in the contract. One of the reasons for that is the maintenance schedule is going to be not given at the time of contract. It's going to be given later on. It would still require maintenance schedules, and of course we've already talked about those schedules being provided at the end of the contract period. It would clarify that one-day cancellation notice is only applicable to custom construction projects. Right now, we believe the law says it's two ways. In other words, sometimes it's for spec homes and sometimes it's for custom homes. It's not clear. And we think what you want is for custom homes only. But we're going to discuss that with you. It would also, in Section 3, clarify that the offer of warranty is clearly applicable to both spec homes as well as custom homes. We believe that's what you want. We don't think that's clear in the law right now. Likewise, we would clarify with this bill that the consumer protection notice needs to be provided for both spec homes as well as custom homes. We believe there's some confusion with that right now. Section 5 would specify when the maintenance schedule should be provided to the public. Right now, it's not clear. It would also, at the request of, or at the suggestion of legislative counsel, change a word specifying to describing. And again, the drafters suggested that change. And then in the back, the last thing this bill would do would be to eliminate the requirement on the part of the Construction Contractors Board to provide at no cost to consumers the maintenance schedule. And the reason why we'd like to do this, quite frankly, is we are low on money. And we're going to put all that material on the website. But one reading of the statute is that we print them and mail them to contractors as they need them. We think that most contractors don't need that. They go to the website. We'll always have this on the website. We think it's a prudent thing to do to take that requirement away. So that's a very high-level review of what this bill does. And again, with your permission, we'll go through it by detail on page 4, section by section.
Is the committee interested in taking a little more time with this in detail? Don't see any objections to it, so please proceed.
Representative Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Dolling, policy analyst with the Construction Contractors Board. Just at the outset, a comment. A lot of really good work was done in 2007 towards consumer protection for people who deal in the construction industry. We've now had about a year and a half to try to work through these various laws and implement them with rules, with forms, getting feedback from folks, and we're just now trying, I think more than anything, to refine this, and that's really all the intent. And where we're not entirely sure, to clarify what we think the legislative policy is, but if we're wrong, you know, that would be great to tell us that we're wrong about that.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that because my memory isn't perfect. And just a comment, I remember this bill quite well, and as some others do in this committee, and I think most of the question marks, I think, happened on the other side of this building in this bill. I think they were pretty clear when they left this committee. Anyway.
So I'll just address this section by section, and I won't spend any more time on it than you want to, but let me just start with Section 1. The first couple changes in there are legislative council changes, and I can describe what they were telling us if you want, but that's really the only reason for the changes in Line 6, 7, and again down in Line 22. The only real substantive change we're recommending is at the very bottom of the bill on page 1, where we remove subsection 2E, acknowledgement of the receipt of the maintenance information, which would be in the contract itself. And the reason for taking this out of the contract provisions is that normally a construction contract is signed before the construction begins. A maintenance schedule is given after the construction's complete. It's a little bit difficult to ask somebody, you know, here's how you're going to, you know, start maintaining your gutters now for the next 6 months when we're still building the house. So that just didn't work on a practical level, and that's why we're suggesting that that just be removed. The maintenance schedule still exists. It's not going away. It'll just be given at a different point in time. That's all.
And before you move up off this, you know, I hate to belabor this too much, but I had written this down, the notice of the moisture intrusion and the maintenance schedule. When a contractor gives that to a consumer and maybe they are providing a warranty and maybe they are not, what kind of, obligations are, legal obligations are being put on the consumer with this notice of maintenance schedule, if any?
Well, Representative Holvey, members of the committee, I'm not sure that there are any specific legal obligations. Initially, I think there was some discussion around the idea that there would be a warranty and a maintenance schedule, and if you didn't maintain it, the warranty could be invalidated. That may still exist under some of the terms of warranties. I'm not sure because the warranties would be so various. You know, we don't have a particular warranty out there. I think when we were doing the research and putting this together, it looked like a lot of contractors had been doing this or started doing this a while ago, especially a lot of the larger contractors. I think the idea was that people were buying a really large investment. Even those people wanted to know what they should be doing and how often they should be doing it. So from that perspective, I think it is a good consumer protection tool. I'm not sure, though, if there has been yet any legal implication. We haven't seen it yet.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Callum.
Thank you. For those of us who, frankly, have no experience whatsoever in this world, and because I see the term used repeatedly, could somebody please tell me what a zero lot line whatever is?
Representative Holden, Representative Cowan, that was added in 2007. I can't recall exactly which bill added that, but my understanding is that it is basically, for lack of a better word, a duplex, where you own your half and somebody else owns their half. It's a zero lot line in the middle. You touch each other at the walls, but you each own your own separate piece. It's not owned by one person.
Yeah, the only thing that separates the property is a wall. It doesn't have a property line with setbacks.
Houses, for instance.
And there could be a whole row of townhouses where you own.
You learn something every day.
Where the owners okay. own each individual unit.
I've never been able to figure out what that reference meant.
Yeah,
Thank you very much.
That's what it is. Essentially. I'm sure there's a better legal description, but...
I didn't need the legal description. I needed an understanding.
Representative Holvey, members of the committee, if we're okay on Section 1, I'll move on to Section 2, which was the one-day right of cancellation. This was another one where we think what the legislative intent was, that this would apply only to custom construction, not to new homes that were built speculatively for sale. The reason we thought this was most likely seemed that if you were going to give a very, very short time for construction, then you probably weren't likely looking so much at somebody who'd gone through the process of deciding to enter into an earnest money to buy an already completed house. This would more be somebody who thought they wanted to do the construction then got cold feet and just said, okay, I really don't want to do this. Again, we could be wrong in our interpretation. We were trying to clarify that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I recall what this was about, and my recollection is it was about remodels. I'm wrong about that. You're shaking your head. But the only reason that I can think that we would do a one day is because, and I remember this discussion, you call someone to come out and do work, you write up the contract, and you'd like them to start right away. You want them to start. You don't want to wait. And that, when you're starting a whole house, that does not make sense to me.
And Representative Riley, it doesn't make sense to me, and now that you say that, I think you're absolutely correct. That was discussion in this committee.
That's right.
And it went to the other side of the chamber and perhaps
changed.
Ended up on the wrong issue from our perspective anyway.
So that's the discussion I remember.
Could have been Chair Holvey and Representative Riley. My memory goes to sitting through the task force meetings.
Oh yeah, I wasn't there.
And I recall talking about how remodeling and most home improvement is covered under the 3-day rescission material for the most part, but new home construction didn't have that kind of provision. And so there was great debate about, shouldn't it have some kind of a right to rescind or a right to change your mind? And so I remember some of that. And, of course, I don't recall everything that happened here in committee. you may be absolutely right with what happened here at committee.
On that note, is there an ability to address Representative Riley's circumstance that he described for a consumer to waive the 3-day right to rescind the contract if they want to get the remodeling started today because it's raining and my roof happens to be leaking?
Chair Holvey, my understanding of the state and federal law is there are provisions that allow for that.
Okay.
And I'd like to see it go back to 3 days for...
It's called a TARP?
Yeah.
Custom homes should be 3 days.
So right now, what the bill's trying to do is clarify that the one-day right of cancellation only applies to new custom homes?
It would apply to construction, improvement, or repair of a property owned by the property owner. It would not apply to the spec home.
Okay.
Section...
What does apply to the spec home, then? Is it 3 days?
3 days.
Probably not. I think, as Craig pointed out, that's probably a more limited provision, too. So there may not be a right of rescission in that instance.
Well, in that their right to cancellation would be in the purchase of the of the home, so they're not really having something built or remodeled. They're buying a home, so it's a real estate transaction, so they actually have protections in rescinding that under real estate law. So that makes sense that it wouldn't apply to the spec homes, but I, like Representative Riley, am a little concerned about the one-day right of cancellation on the custom homes being a little short compared to a remodel or anything else. So anyway, let's let you finish. We're not going to belabor that issue.
Section 3 is another section where we think we know what the legislative intent was. It starts out by saying that the contractor that enters into a contract to construct a new residential structure or sell a new to construct a new residential structure shall make a written offer to the first purchaser or owner. That's the way it was originally written. So it said in the one phrase, construct, and in the other phrase, written offer to the first purchaser or owner. Our assumption was that you wanted to include both spec houses. That would be the reason for putting first purchaser in there, and custom construction. That was the reason for owner. However, when we asked the Attorney General for an interpretation of this statute, they said, no, it can only be limited to construction, the custom home, because of the use of that verb, construct. So thinking that's probably not what was intended, we propose this clarification. Section 4, again, this is another one where the consumer notice form we think should be applicable for both custom and spec homes. There didn't seem to be any real reason not to include both of those. So that was the intent here in drafting the language to make it clear that it would be both of those. It's just a notice form that would protect both. Some of the language, the wording original purchaser, that was a suggestion of legislative counsel. They liked it better than first purchaser. And then Section 5, which is the maintenance schedule again. Again, we're trying to reflect the reality that the maintenance schedule is going to be provided at the completion, not when the home is under construction, because it's not possible at that point to be doing maintenance on the being constructed home. And some of the wording here also, such as changing the word specifying to describing, was a suggestion of legislative counsel. And then the last one in Section 5 that Craig made reference to, the board will make the information available, meaning the maintenance schedule, without charge to contractors. We were somewhat concerned, not terribly concerned, but somewhat concerned somebody might interpret that to mean we actually had to print and mail and publish this information, which is quite costly and uses up a lot of resources. And our intent and what we've done is we've made that schedule you've seen that we had in the PowerPoint. It's available on the website, so it can be just downloaded, printed, and given to the customers. And I think our contractors are comfortable with that because that's what they do with all these notice requirements.
And so before you move off that topic, it kind of brings back a question I had about this maintenance schedule being delivered to the homeowner. And I can understand that maintenance doesn't happen until after the construction is complete. However, if you are also purchasing a warranty with the home up front, and you want a warranty, it seems to me that you would want a reasonable maintenance schedule. If the maintenance schedule is a requirement of making the warranty effective, you know, you would want to see what your required maintenance was to be able to perfect a warranty claim. And if the maintenance schedule actually came out after you purchased it with the warranty as well, and you found out that they're requiring me to paint my house every year, that seems quite unreasonable, and a new roof every 5 years instead of every 20, you know, in order to protect my warranty, would seem sort of unreasonable. We don't have any laws that would prevent something like that from happening. So I recognize the practicality of what you're proposing, but I'm also cautious, I guess, on this. But anyway, maybe you can address that particular issue.
Representative Holvey, I would have one comment. We did do quite a bit of research into this, and it does appear that the warranties that exist out there, and there are some that are offered, made available from large companies, that you're right, they're pretty well packaged together. And a lot of those companies also, the contracting companies are large companies that have their own already prepackaged maintenance schedules. They could go out at the initial part, at the outset. They could go out sometime a little bit later in the construction process, or they could go out as late as, I suppose, the end of the process. What we didn't want to set up was a situation necessarily to penalize a contractor because you didn't get that thing out there that first day, when you really can't do anything with it yet. The other notices we do require, you know, you have to get those out there with that contract, and there are civil penalties if you don't do that.
I guess where I'm going is, and that's fine with me with how you describe it, but in fact, if you're providing a warranty, it seems like the maintenance schedule should be included in that warranty offer. And not later on.
If the warranty is required.
Especially because I would imagine that to perfect a warranty claim, you're going to have to prove that you, mm-hmm. you know, change the oil every 3,000 miles like they called for. And so it seems very important to me that maintenance schedule be included in any kind of warranty offer. I don't know if we can make that happen.
Yeah, Representative Holvey, I think that was a problem, as I recall, in the 2007 legislation. That was the original concept that came out of the task force, was to tie those two things together and require the warranty. But it didn't come out that way. When it came through the final legislation, we ended up with the offer of warranty on the one hand, which doesn't even tell us what kind of warranty it is. It could be literally anything.
Yeah.
And then a maintenance schedule on the other hand, and two totally different statutes. And so we've tried to, you know, make sure that everybody knows what those requirements are, but they're not tied together. And, you know, there obviously will be some good policy reasons to tie them together, but that's not the law that we have.
Okay, thank you. Making mental notes.
And that's all I have.
Oh, that's it?
Yes.
Oh, we are at the end. Thank you. Questions, committee? Sorry, I didn't mean to monopolize it myself, but...
Yes, you did.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Chair. Since we have both bills open, I'd like to go back to something that was talked about in 203, and that was the summary. You wanted to take the summary out of the contract, and I have a thought about that, and I just wanted to toss this out. And I know that if the contractor sits down and goes through all the paperwork with the client, and that they see all these notices and they understand what they are, But the summary of notices, it tells them what notices they should have seen. And that seems like something that is of value. Because if they don't have that summary of notices, they don't know what notices they should have seen.
And so I'd like, if I'm the consumer, I'd like, and somebody's going through a lot of pages of notices, I'd like something somewhere that says, here's a list of all the notices that you should have seen. It may not need to be in the contract, but in my mind, it needs to be somewhere and needs to be required.
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, not a bad thought. You know, I guess the problem is this, is that you reach a point, I think, as a consumer, I know I have, when I sat down and bought my house, where I'm not looking much at that paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
Today, with the notice that we provide, we require that there is a signature page. We require that the contractor deliver that notice and that they either get, and they get some proof that the consumer, that they have delivered it. There are three ways to prove that. One is that they actually make it part of the contract, the entire notice, and some contractors do that, a lot of them do. Particularly then, it seems redundant.
Mm-hmm.
Other contractors make the other way that they can prove that they gave this notice is that they, a little thing in the contract that says, I got the notice, initial here. And then the last way is that they actually sign the notice. So, I mean, if they don't comply with that, they violated the law. If they have complied with one of those, the consumer has gotten the information, arguably.
Except for that middle one where they say, I got the notice. There's more than one notice. There are multiple notices. And if it just says, I got the notice, and doesn't say, here's what those notices were, and the contract is something that the consumer presumably will keep forever. And that seems like a good place to enumerate what they saw. I just don't want to, I'm trying to stop the, if I'm the consumer and I'm say, gosh, I don't know if I saw this, but it's right there in the contract. Here it is. Here are the things that you were presented and you signed and said, yeah, I got those. It seems like a good thing to me.
You know, I definitely, Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, Vice Chair Riley, I couldn't argue that. There's an argument there, and we can amend the bill. There's some other parts of the bill. If that's the will, I can tell you that respectfully, you know, I see it a little different.
I do. I understand.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Vice Chair Riley, are you getting at kind of a checklist so that you can at least go back and say, whenever it is you want to focus on it, you can say, what were all the documents again?
Mm-hmm.
Well, why can't, you know, I think that's something you could do. That either could be, because each situation's different, but even if it was online and it was a list of, here are the possible documents that may have been involved in your situation. I mean, that doesn't get completely at what you're saying.
Consumers don't go online to look at it. The contractors will.
I tend to agree with you, Representative.
Any other discussion?
Yeah, I have one other point.
Another point, Representative Gilliam.
Back to 205. I would just say that on this, eliminate the requirement that you make the maintenance schedule without charge. That wording or removing it's a little awkward to me, and I really liked your explanation, and I agree with it. That isn't, I think you agree, that's probably a good place for it to be online. But you are providing it at no charge. So maybe it doesn't need to be worded. I wouldn't suggest an amendment, but the point is, I like the idea of not charging of the consumer, and I like the idea of saving money. So I don't know if you need to eliminate it or you just do it that way by rule.
Well, the is the information that you're providing without charge is not to the consumer but to the contractor. Am I missing something here?
Okay. Chair Holby, the way the statute is set up right now, it requires the agency to provide arguably the paper to the contractor.
That's what I meant, not the consumer. You're right.
Oh, okay. I thought I was missing something.
Yeah, they go online all the
time. And they will, because that's part of their business.
Mm-hmm. All right. Representative Widener.
Thank you, President Holby. He's president to me. 203, I am good with. The only thing to protect Representative Gilliam's, you know, I wouldn't be against taking it, they're going from 1 to 2 years, but maybe putting that out at 5 years. To help out the contractors, because we are contractor protection, because they are consumers, so they would fall under us protecting them as well, especially in this time of crisis. So I think it's the least we could do for the contractors is give them a little more time before they'd have to retake the test again.
And Representative Holby, and Vice Chair, Vice President, Vice Chair, there's another issue that while we're offline talking about passing those other bills out that Kathy was reminding me of, and it has to do with the backdating that we do of licenses. And this is a kind of an inside baseball type of thing that is very helpful to contractors. When they have not been licensed for a while, what they'll do is they'll be able to get insurance and a bond that covers them for that unlicensed period. Very good for consumers, very good for the contractor, because they, even though they've had a period that they could end up getting disciplined for, if they can have their license backdated during that period of time, it benefits them and benefits their customers. It's a practical problem to go past 2 years, I've been reminded. And perhaps we could have a two-tier system where you can backdate up to 2 years, but maybe you can, you know, renew past that, but it gets pretty complicated. And so, I would just offer to you that we haven't had much call for folks to have a renewal past 2 years. All we've had them say to us is, why the heck can't we get 2 years out of this? And of course, we threw up our hands and said, we'll fix that. We'll go to the legislature, we'll explain what the problem is, and we'll fix it. So I'm here to tell you we haven't had that request, and maybe it's a problem that, you know, that we could handle another day.
Yes, I was just thinking, if they ask for two, let's give them five.
all the same, we could be as generous going the other direction too on some things. So, Craig, on this issue, I mean, but these bills and the concepts in these bills have been vetted through the Construction Contractors Board as well, I'm sure, and so they've been supportive of most of these recommendations that we see in these bills right now.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, that's right. Of course, the board has blessed all these, but also we've gone through them with any interested groups, including home builders and remodelers and such, and we've got buy-in from those. At least we have no opposition, and we've explained them over and over again. And so I'm here to say we've got something we could do, we can move forward with, I think, without any opposition, and I'd beg your consideration of that.
And I appreciate that, and I'm confident we'll be moving these two bills forward. However, I'm not compelled to do it today. I have, at least one and maybe two issues that we would, sure, we'd like to pursue, and perhaps have a conversation with Senator Metzger on the other side and see if he'd be amenable to an amendment on this side on one of these bills, at least, anyway. And I want to have an opportunity. I'm surprised the home builders, or there's no representatives from industry here today. because I'd like an opportunity to talk to them about it as well, to be sure. So that's kind of my intent right now. So without any further ado, I really appreciate the thorough job you've done going through these bills for this particular committee. As you know, it's been an all interest of Representative Gilliam's for and Representative Riley's and myself for quite some time. So I appreciate your testimony and your time today.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll be talking some more about this soon.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 205 and close the Senate public hearing on Senate Bill 203A. And I'd like to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 141A, and I would like to suspend the rules so that Representative Matthews can vote on Senate Bill 141A. Is there any objection to the suspension of rules?
No objection.
Seeing none, Representative Matthews, how do you vote on Senate Bill 141A?
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews votes aye. With that, it's so noted, and doesn't change the outcome, of course, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 141A and open a work session on Senate Bill 188A, and I'd move that we suspend the rules again to allow Representative Matthews to vote on Senate Bill 188A. Is there any objection to that suspension of rules? Seeing none. Representative Matthews, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Matthews votes aye on Senate Bill 188A. Doesn't change the outcome. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 188A and open a work session on Senate Bill 685. And I would like to suspend the rules again to allow Representative Matthews to vote on Senate Bill 685. Any objection to the suspension of rules? Seeing none. Representative Matthews, how do you vote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I vote aye.
Representative Matthews votes aye on Senate Bill 685. Doesn't change the outcome. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 685. And
Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Widener.
I would like to thank you for being so gracious with Representative Matthews, because that was very generous of you.
Thank you. I try to be generous when I remember to. With that, committee, we are not scheduled to meet on Friday.
Oh.
That's wonderful, Mr. Chair.
Oh.
So I know you will have a wonderful afternoon. So with that, on Monday, on Monday we will have Senate Bill 438A, Senate Bill 239A, Senate Bill 240, and Senate Bill 386A. So I will be back in this committee on Monday. With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Protection.